Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to this event here tonight, which is organized by the LSE's Southeast Asia Center. My name is Jürgen Harke. I'm a faculty member in the International Relations Department, and I'm also an associate of the LSE's Southeast Asia Center. Tonight we will be talking about Burma, Myanmar, and as you know, a lot of momentous events have happened in this country over the last couple of years, especially since 2011. More recently, obviously, we have seen the formation of a new government, an NLD-led government in Myanmar, which is in effect headed by Aung San Suu Kyi. And this was possible because, in part, of the election results in November of 2015, when the NLD won a huge victory against the other political parties in the country. Indeed, you might ask as to how it was possible for the electoral victory to be so decisive. Many commentators and analysts arguably would not have predicted a victory on this particular scale, and thus deserves a lot of explaining. And this is in part what our guest tonight, that I will introduce in a minute, will do, Peter Popham. Before, however, I introduce our guest and speaker for tonight, I would just like to point you to another event that the LSE's Southeast Asia Center will be organizing on the 13th of May. We will be having our inaugural LSE Southeast Asia Forum on that day. That forum will be a unique opportunity for all those intending to engage with Southeast Asia's most critical issues. It will be possible to network with a number of renowned experts on the region, and will also allow for student participation in high-level debates. Panel discussions on that day will focus on ASEAN security, religion in Southeast Asia, as well as inclusive growth, and the keynotes will be delivered by His Excellency, the Indonesian Ambassador, as well as the Lao Ambassador to the UK. You can go to the LSE Southeast Asia, Sosui Hock Southeast Asia Center website for further information. Returning, however, to tonight's event, it is my great pleasure, I'm delighted that he's here, to introduce to you Peter Popham, a journalist and author who's worked for The Independent for a good 20 years or so, and who has lived abroad extensively in countries such as Japan, India, as well as Italy. He has written a lot about Burma in the past. In fact, I recommend to you a very good biography, which he did some years back, which is called The Lady and the Peacock. And he has added to this, and this will form the basis, I presume, for tonight's talk, a second book on Daw Su, albeit in the context of the contemporary political developments. And this book is The Lady and the Generals, Aung San Suu Kyi and Burma's Struggle for Freedom. If you haven't already purchased a copy, you may do so.
Thank you, Jürgen.
Later after this talk, which will finish after the Q&A around 7:30. There will also be a signing by the author of the individual copies that you may have purchased by then. However, before we go into that, I would like to invite Peter Popham to the podium and deliver his talk for tonight, which is entitled, How Did Aung San Suu Kyi Win So Big? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Can we have that map on the thing? Oh, brilliant, thanks. Good Good evening. Very nice to be here, and thank you very much to Lev for the invitation. So I brought the reasons I'm here are really essentially contained in these two books, published 5 years apart. The Lady and the Peacock, published in 2011, and this one which has just come out, The Lady and the Generals. When I began researching this book, The Lady and the Peacock, which is subtitled The Life of Aung San Suu Kyi, it was in the mid-2000s, and it didn't look a very promising subject for a biography. At the time, she was in the middle of her 15-plus years of house arrest, where she was kept completely incommunicado, without any contact with her party or with the outside world, for the best part of 20 years, with a few little interludes of freedom in the middle of that time. And she, of course, she'd already received the Nobel Peace Prize, but she'd been largely forgotten by the general public, and the world knew very little about her and expected less, it could be said. So the biography of her, which appeared before mine, was called Perfect Hostage, which was a rather harsh title, suggesting that being a hostage, indefinitely locked up in her home by the regime, was probably the most that she could expect to achieve. And this is a persistent theme I've noticed in the treatment of Sue. She is constantly confounding people's low expectations. It's probably there's some sexism in there. There's the fact that she was a housewife and described herself as a housewife for a long time, for many years, the years when she was living in England and married. There's also the fact that before becoming a housewife and mother and a part-time academic at SOAS, she had no political involvement and really no apparent interest in politics. So the fact that she had suddenly risen to fame in Burma and had then almost immediately been locked away, that seemed to be the extent of her potential achievement. Well, how wrong we all were. In 2010, she was finally released. And even at that point, it wasn't at all clear what might happen next. We didn't know why she'd been released. A week before her release, the regime had staged a general election, which was a complete fix, in which the regime's proxy party won a huge majority, and her party, the National League for Democracy, was not even participating because one of the requirements of registering as a political party for the election was that they expel all of their members who were or had been political prisoners. So to participate in the election would have required that they expel Aung San Suu Kyi and all her colleagues. So that didn't happen. So she emerged in 2010, and again there was the question of what she might go on to achieve. So from the perspective of 2010, the fact that barely 5 years later, she is now, as we know, essentially the de facto head of a government with a commanding majority in parliament, is an astounding fact. And this is the fact which I would like to try to talk about this evening, try to explain how this woman, whose political career was so brief, has managed to command the enthusiastic support of tens of millions of Burmese right across the country. In the West, as I say, we really knew very little about Aung San Suu Kyi, but on the basis of the little we knew back in 1990, when she was won the Nobel Peace Prize, we constructed a sort of saintly persona of this self-sacrificing person who was devoting herself single-mindedly to the creation of democracy in Burma. And as a result, we created a rather two-dimensional figure because there was simply so little known about her. In the years since 2010, the mood in the West has changed considerably. Doubts have arisen. I've noticed this every time that I raise her name in conversation with somebody who is not a specialist on Burma, who just has passing knowledge about it. They say, well, yes, we used to think she was great, but not quite so sure anymore. And the focus of these doubts about her in the West is on the fact that she has, although she is an icon of the struggle for human rights, she has been singularly uneloquent about one of Burma's worst human rights tragedies, that of the Rohingya minority in Arakan State in the far west of Burma. Arakan State being here, and Sitwe, the capital here, Bangladesh here, right on the extreme edge of Burma. And the Rohingya, as I'm sure many of you know, have long had a marginal political presence in Burma and have been suffered a degree of persecution. They are stateless. The term Rohingya is one which the Burmese government refuses to use, and for a lot of them the only hope of any kind of a decent life, and it's a very slim hope, is to get onto a smuggler's boat and head across the sea towards Malaysia or Indonesia, and many have died in the process. So it's a glaring and terrible situation, and many people have asked Aung San Suu Kyi to speak about it, and she has never spoken with a great deal of firmness or clarity. She still seems to be rather evasive about it. And this is the issue which I think more than any other has led to people in the West feeling rather ambivalent about her, thinking, well, she was great, we thought she was fantastic, but maybe she's not quite as fantastic as we thought. So it was on my last two visits to Burma, both of them last year. Of course, I came from Britain with these rather ambivalent thoughts about Aung San Suu Kyi ringing in my mind, and particularly during the election period, I was struck by the way that these ambivalent feelings were not shared at all by the Burmese people I spoke to. And I'm talking about Burmese of educated class, who are well-established, people of all ages, from in their teens right up to their 70s and 80s. I went to rallies of the NLD in the weeks leading up to the election, and one met an extraordinary degree of not just support for the NLD, that wasn't really it, but it was conviction that the NLD, as led by Aung San Suu Kyi, was going to transform the country and was in fact the only thing that could transform the country. I was at a small local rally in Rangoon about 10 days before the election, and among the children playing, some of whom had Aung San Suu Kyi headbands around their heads, there was one man who showed me his chest with an Aung San tattoo on it. There was a sort of party atmosphere, and a lot of the people involved were very, very young. And there was this ancient chap sitting on a chair amidst all this youthful hubbub. And I had a word with him via my wonderful assistant, and I asked him why he was there, why he'd come to this rally, and he said, I have supported the NLD since 1988, in other words, since its foundation. Everything needs to change in this country. I have suffered. All the Burmese people have been suffering for many years in many different ways. I believe that the NLD is the one organization that can totally change our country. Ellen, you couldn't really hope for a more ringing endorsement of a political party than that. And it left one scratching one's head a bit, because the NLD has got plenty of problems. It's while Aung San Suu Kyi was in house arrest, it was basically in hibernation. It is a party very much dominated by her, and it has great organisational strengths, which became apparent during the election. The rallies were organised magnificently. The headquarters, the crowd management, was done with a great deal of efficiency and initiative. But politically, it is not a strong party, and she dominates it in a way that has been called autocratic, and I think that may well be the correct word for it. But this did not change the view of the people I spoke to. Another old man who I spoke to at another rally, who had been a government employee throughout his life, told me, "I believe the NLD can bring peace, change the constitution, and implement law, order, and justice." Outside the NLD headquarters itself, as the results came in and it became clear that there was a massive victory, a younger chap said to me, "We trust her completely. We stand with the NLD. I hope she can change the constitution. She will be our Abraham Lincoln." And again, the whole experience for me was of the election was a very moving one. I've covered elections in many countries, but I've never seen such an outpouring of enthusiasm and conviction that the country was going to change and that they were going to change it for the first time since 1958. They were going to vote, the vote was going to be counted, and the counting of the vote would lead to change, and Aung San Suu Kyi and her party would change the whole country. That was it in a nutshell. And to explain exactly why so many people I spoke to had this conviction, we need to see a few things about her and about Burma. As many of you will know, she was the daughter of General Aung San, the founder of the Burmese army and the man who negotiated Burma's independence with Clement Attlee's government, but who was assassinated in 1947 before he could become Burma's first prime minister. So he was the foundational figure who gave the freshly independent Burmese the perfect symbol of nationhood. And in a way, the fact that he was not there to try and pull it all together was a great loss and a great problem for Burma, but it ensured that he would remain on that pedestal for many years to come. And Aung San Suu Kyi was only two when he died. Her memories of him were very vague. But as she said many times, she was brought up by soldiers. Many of the people who had served alongside her father came to the family home and played with her and made much of her. And she's often spoken affectionately about the army as being the people who her sort of loving uncles, really, when she was young. The first thing she wanted to do in life when she was a young girl was to become a general, until it was pointed out to her that girls could not become generals in the Burmese army. But the idea that she was the legacy of an extraordinary man, and this brought with it certain potential and certain duties, was clearly very deeply etched in her mind. She was studied politics, philosophy, and economics at Oxford from 1967. And although most students around her knew very little about Burma and next to nothing about her father, she made sure that they learned. It was clear even from her student days that her possible destiny, her birthright were very important issues to her. She always dressed in a Burmese way. And according to some people, she had a sort of semi-regal manner even then. I met a senior judge a few weeks ago who was her contemporary at Oxford and said, I'd asked him, well, were you friends with her? And he said, she was impossibly grand. Which is quite something when you're only 18 to be impossibly grand. She'd left Burma when she was 15 because her mother had been appointed Burma's ambassador to India and the family moved to Delhi. So she had actually been away from the country for the whole of her adult life, almost all of it in England after the first few years in India. And the idea of somehow making something of this birthright was very vaguely present in her mind, but only very vaguely. She became engaged to an Englishman called Michael Arris, who was a Tibet scholar and later became a lecturer in Tibet studies in Oxford. But before they married, she wrote him a series of letters in which she made it clear that Burma was still, however vaguely, very much in her mind. As he wrote in 1991, from her earliest childhood, Suu Kyi has been deeply preoccupied with the question of what she might do to help her people. She never for a moment forgot that she was the daughter of Burma's national hero. She always used to say that if her people ever needed her, she would not fail them. She constantly reminded me that one day she would have to return to Burma. And he quoted some of the letters that she wrote to him before their marriage. She wrote, I only ask one thing, that should my people need me, you would help me to do my duty by them. That was way back in the 1970s, in the first years of their marriage. Then we fast forward through the years of motherhood and early writing a few small books, becoming a part-time student at SOAS, never really getting close to Burma. She went to Japan for a year to research a biography of her father. She wrote a very small volume of a kind of almost like the project of a biography, just a small volume. So it was constantly at the back of her mind as a project, but it never attained any sort of momentum. It never came close to realization. Then at the end of February in 1988, she got a phone call from a family friend in Rangoon to say that her mother had had an appalling stroke, had been taken to Rangoon General Hospital, and it was feared that she would not recover. And she immediately jumped on the first available flight to take her to Rangoon, knowing what medical conditions were like in Rangoon, and essentially moved into Rangoon General Hospital and stayed there with her mother, sleeping in the same room for weeks and months after that, nursing her and trying to bring her back to health. And as it happened, it was in those months that the greatest democratic uprising in independent Burma's history had broken out in Rangoon and other cities. And it was provoked by the decision of Ne Win's increasingly eccentric government to demonetize some of the highest value banknotes, which essentially impoverished large parts of the population, including the students, who, as a result, in their fury, took to the street in large numbers in demonstrations which went on throughout 1988. But she was not involved at all. She was in her mother's hospital room in Rangoon General Hospital. And then she moved back to her house on this rather grand old colonial house on the lake in Rangoon. And she played no part. All the crowds of demonstrators, many of them killed in violent clashes with the armed forces. This uprising was raging around her, and she was not involved. But a number of intellectuals and students and other people involved in the uprising battered on her door and said, "Can you please help us, please participate in this?" And the reason for doing so was not because they thought she had some political acumen, but because she had the name of Aung San. She had within her family DNA, she had the legitimacy of the country. And it took a lot of her persuading. She was there in Rangoon, in the family home, with Michael, with Kim and Alex, their two sons, who had come over for the summer holidays. She was totally embedded in a perfectly ordinary middle-class English life. And they were saying, "Come and join us." And it was clear there was a major struggle within her mind and long discussions with Michael, finally leading to the day of the 26th of August 1988, when she said, "Yes, I will. I will talk to a demonstration." And the demonstration was outside Shwedagon Pagoda, the most revered shrine in the whole country. There's a magnificent pagoda that still today is the central, the thing that draws one's eye in Rangoon. It was massive. According to U Win Tin, a late colleague of her, there might have been a million people there. There was a large proportion of the population of Rangoon was gathered. And this woman, who had never addressed a public meeting before in her life, stood up there and bawled. You can see this on YouTube, but it's very moving. She shouted into the very inadequate sound system the first speech which she ever gave, which was very, very clear. Very clear and very brave. "Reverend monks and people, this public rally is aimed at informing the whole world of the will of the people. Our purpose is to show that the entire people entertain the keenest desire for a multi-party system of government. I believe that all the people assembled here have, without exception, come with the unshakable desire to strive for and win a multi-party democratic system." It wasn't bad for a first speech. I mean, it couldn't actually have been any clearer. And it was an overnight. I mean, she became an overnight success. It became quite clear to the leaders of this uprising that here was a person who would be a marvelous figurehead, very, very beautiful, remarkably similar in her looks to her father, and now suddenly and quite unexpectedly so eloquent in support of the democratic movement. And it was within a couple of months that she and U Win Tin and a handful of other people had formed the National League for Democracy. And then you have this extraordinary period of 6 or 7 months leading up to July 1989, when she basically stormed across the country, addressing one huge meeting after another in complete defiance of martial law, which had actually banned all gatherings of more than four people. And it's fair to say that she swept all before her, and that millions of people joined the party, and the whole political atmosphere of Burma changed irrevocably. By the way, it was in those months that the military regime, which was at that time called the State Law and Order Restoration Council, or SLORC, decided that they would change the name by which the country was referred to internationally from Burma to Myanmar, and Rangoon to Yangon, and Pagan to Bagan, etc., etc. And the reason why the NLD and many other people, including me, dislike using the term Myanmar is not because it's an illegitimate term, but because the people who imposed it had no legitimacy. They did so without any democratic justification. They were simply self-appointed generals imposing their will. And in a way, trying rather desperately to steer the country away from the Aung San legacy. Suddenly you had this woman who looked so much like her father and was saying, actually, I'm legitimate. These people have no legitimacy. They are tyrannical. They're just as tyrannical as the British before them in the same sort of way. And this is the second struggle for independence. That was her original term, the second struggle for independence. And it resonated with everybody, and it resonated in a most fearful way for the generals, because what it said to them was, we have the arms, we have the power, like the British did before, but we don't have legitimacy. And really, the story of the next 1989 up to 2010, 2012, if you like, the story of this long period of more than 20 years is the desperate attempt by the military to get some hold on legitimacy, and ultimately the failure to get some hold on legitimacy, ultimately the failure to persuade the Burmese people that they have the right to rule. So this heroic period in 1989, when the NLD went from absolutely nothing to much the biggest democratic party in Burma's history, came to a sudden shuddering halt in July 1989, when the regime, Ne Win, was still in charge, although increasingly frail. The regime decided that things had gone too far. They threw all of Suu Kyi's colleagues in jail and they put her under house arrest. And the whole democratic movement came to a sudden halt. And the next year, in 1990, they held the election, which I think I mentioned earlier, believing in their simplicity that the people would vote for the army. And for the army's proxy party. And on the contrary, the people voted enormous numbers for the NLD. They won a landslide majority. The army was massively embarrassed, and the only way they dealt with it was, well, actually, this wasn't an election at all. It was an election, but not for a government. It was an election for a constitutional convention, which was an enormous lie. But it's a lie which has been repeated by disgraceful academics from time to time ever since. And then, basically, Burma went into a deep freeze, from which it emerged in 2010 with the release of Aung San Suu Kyi from house arrest. In August of 2011, she had what I think is undoubtedly, we can call, a historic meeting with the new president, Thein Sein, an ex-general himself. We don't know what happened at the meeting, but we know the photograph that was taken at the end of it, which showed her looking rather uncomfortable, Thein Sein grinning, and a photograph of Aung San Suu Kyi's father, above them both. And it was a highly symbolic moment, because it was the way Thein Sein sort of came clean in a way. He said, well, okay, here she is. She's the one you want. We're going to do business with her. Because he was clever enough to realize that only by involving her in the political process would sanctions be removed, would the political engagement with the outside world resume again. And over the following 6, 8, 9 months, Thein Sein pushed through a raft of reforms. Some Burmese say, with reason, that they're superficial, but from the point of view of what went before, the whole temper, the whole mood of the country changed, because political prisoners were released in large numbers. International organizations came back into the country. The media were allowed to print much more of what they wanted to print. Not everything, but much more. A ceasefire was signed with the Karen National Union, who had been fighting the Burmese army ever since independence. It was really quite a dramatic period. And Nobody quite understands why Faye and Thane did it, but having done it, it was sort of irrevocable. Aung San Suu Kyi was allowed to run for parliament. She stood for a constituency south of Rangoon and won 99% of the vote. And she began, for the first time, she began her political career proper as an MP in the new parliament in Naypyidaw. Naypyidaw, the rather empty new Burmese capital in the middle of the country. So then we had the 5 years, which are basically I'm writing about in my new book, The Lady and the Generals, what happened between her release from house arrest to the election, which I covered for The Independent. And it's been, from the point of view of an outside commentator like myself, it's been a curious period, because for the first time we've really got to see Aung San Suu Kyi as a political figure, rather than simply as a symbol or as a suffering person under house arrest. And as I mentioned earlier on, there are problems with the way she runs her party. When she came to London in 2012 and she addressed the Great Hall at Westminster, both Houses of Parliament, fantastic occasion. And then after she went to see William Hague, who was then the Foreign Secretary. But instead of being taken directly in to see him, as would normally happen, she was taken right through the foreign ministry to see all of to be shown, in a way, to be taken through all the ranks of the different advisors and secretaries and experts whose counsel goes to form the foreign secretary's decisions. And it was explained to me that this was done to try to make her understand that she couldn't do everything entirely by herself, that she would need to have people advising her. She'd need to create a however small a group of trusted, well-educated, informed Burmese people to help her to reach good decisions on foreign policy, which was, it was a well-meant effort, which has, as far as we can tell, yielded no results. So you see photographs appear in the press of the Indian delegation led by the Indian Prime Minister with a translator and 10 or 12 or 15 other men in suits. And facing them is Aung San Suu Kyi and her trusty assistant, Dr. Tin Ma Ong, who is the person who she has always seen with, her chief of staff. But there's only the two of them. There's all these Indians and these two Burmese, and that is the normal thing. As I detail in my book, the result is chaos in her office. There is no reliable structure in the office. So very important people come to Burma in the expectation of having a useful, constructive, important meeting. For example, George Soros, the billionaire financier, who has been an immense supporter for people like the Burma Campaign UK and many other organisations financing the movement for democracy in Burma, had enormous difficulty in getting an appointment with her. Now, we journalists struggle as well, but when people like that, who have helped her cause and have helped Burma so much, cannot get meetings, it's strange. It seems disorganized. Journalists have essentially given up. It's the last time she gave an in-depth interview to a foreign journalist is basically a long time back. And when the very good Burma correspondent of the New York Times, Thomas Fuller, asked Dr. Tin Ma Ong when do you think I might be able to get an interview with Aung San Suu Kyi? She replied, never! Well, it's so strange, because one would think that, you know, she was one of the more accessible of Asian leaders. Instead, she is becoming increasingly inaccessible, and she's doing her best to prevent the people within her party from saying anything too. I mention all these not to try to predict that things are going to go badly, because, as I say, Aung San Suu Kyi has been underestimated over and over and over again. But to say that these negative impressions, which have found their way into more and more of the things that people write about Aung San Suu Kyi, have had absolutely no impression on the opinions of the Burmese public about her. The opinion of the Burmese public, the ones I met, including people who are now MPs, including teenagers, including retired people, everybody from uneducated to highly educated people, are solidly behind her. And the key to that is the fact that ever since she entered politics on the 26th of August 1988, she has borne the precious burden, if you like, of legitimacy. She is seen by many millions of Burmese as the person who has the right, as a monarch, as a hereditary monarch has the right to rule. And this is why there is no protest when she tries to become president and fails and then becomes state councillor, which is essentially prime minister. I sense that the Burmese people are very happy with that. They say, give her all the range she can have and let her do her best for us. So as we are just at the beginning of her administration, my feeling is that despite all the caveats and the problems that I've identified, with this strong wind of support, we may yet see wonderful results in Burma in the next 3 or 4 years. Thank you very much. Shall I come and sit down? Yeah.
We will now be moving to the Q&A part of this evening. And as you can see, we do have microphones. So if you would like to ask a question, please raise your hand and somebody will come to you and give you the microphone. It might also be helpful if you could just maybe identify yourself when asking the question. We'd like to give you a start. Yes, the gentleman here. Yeah, reflection.
My name is Robert Wallace. I'm a freelance journalist. Peter, I was just wondering if you could speak more about her refusal to take a stand on the Rohingya, whether it was a coldly calculated political decision that she thought was necessary for the election, or whether it's something deeper where she, in fact, can't empathize with this situation.
Thanks. I think one has to make the best stab at this, because she has not been clear herself. But in my book, I quoted something that Roy Jenkins said about Tony Blair after 1997. He said that Tony Blair carried the Labour Party to the general election in 1997, like a man carrying a precious Ming vase across a highly polished floor. And I feel that Aung San Suu Kyi's approach to the NLD's performance in the election of last year was a bit like that. She was not taking any chances. Well over 80% of Burmese are Buddhists. Quite a lot of them are unfortunately prejudiced against Muslims. There is a particular long-standing problem with the Rohingya because of the communal strife in Arakan State between the Rohingya and the Arakanese Buddhists. It is toxic territory for a Buddhist politician. And what makes it worse for her, potentially, is that when her enemies in Burma try to attack her, one of their favourite approaches is to say, well, look how how long she lived outside the country. Her husband was British. Her children are not Burmese. Is she really Burmese? No. She's another foreigner, like all these Bengalis in Arakan State. There is the risk of being lumped with the disliked or even hated Muslims in the far west of the country. And I think she has wanted to steer very, very clear of that territory.
Even with her legacy.
Yeah. Well, you see, the West, the UN, Amnesty International, don't have any votes in Burmese elections.
The next question, yes.
Thank you for your excellent talk, Peter. My name is Anton Alifandi. I'm a Southeast Asia analyst, but not a Burma specialist. I'm more an Indonesia person. Can you give us some sense on what her relationship is like with the military and how much power she wields in the new government, given that the military still has a lot of control in political and security affairs?
Even before the election, the NLD was trying very hard to change the constitution because the constitution guarantees the military control of three key ministries, defence, home ministry and border affairs. It gives them 25% of MPs who serve wearing uniforms, and they dominate Defence and Security Council, which can declare martial law at any time. So even with a successful and legitimate democratic process, the army has holds enormous strategic positions within the Burmese politics. Her relations with the army have not been good on the whole. They've been, and I put it down to, well, a very close friend of hers told me that they're terrified of her. They're terrified to take the first step towards her. And the one exception to that proves that rule. He was a general called Thura Shweman, who was the Speaker of the Lower House of Parliament, and who went out of his way to become her political friend in Parliament. In a way that was quite courageous, if you like, but also resulted in him alienating the Army High Command. In fact, in the last couple of days, he has been expelled from the ruling party. So the relations have been fraught, and there's no indication that they're going to be smooth. But it's been pointed out to me that if she thinks that she's the only person, the only Democrat in Burma who could actually work with the army, she's probably right. Because of her dad, because Aung San founded the Burmese army, there is this residue of recognition of who she is and who she is the child of. So she may be the best person for that job, in fact.
All right, yes, at the very back. Yes, with the scarf, the lady with the scarf.
Hi, I'm Sonali. I work at the LSE South Asia Centre. There was a really interesting briefing by the Southeast Asia Centre before the elections, and one of the things that came up in that was her reluctance to make alliances with students, with some of the ethnic groups, with a lot of the other kind of potentially politically powerful forces. And I just wondered, you talk about great popularity for her, but are these potential fault lines, and how much is she doing to cultivate / work with these groups or not, and sort of where do you see those things going?
I think she's certainly aware that creating peace in Burma, bringing peace to a country that has essentially been in civil war ever since the Declaration of Independence is one of her top two or three priorities. And it's what you say is correct. I mean, she got enormous support, much more support than many people expected, from ethnic groups, including, for example, the Kachin, including groups which have been fighting the Burmese army for a long time and which are afraid of and suspicious of Burman domination, because the Burman who occupy, map's gone, the heartland of Burma have dominated the country for hundreds of years. So the dream which was sort of floated in the Panglong Agreement of 1947 of Burma as a country in which the different ethnic groups are work together with a great deal of autonomy allowed to the ethnic groups is clearly something which the NLD is committed to, but we haven't yet seen any concrete steps in that direction. And I guess it's probably too early. I mean, the thing is, it's too early for us to judge this government, but one certainly hopes that those bridges are going to be created fairly quickly.
All right, I think there was a further question. Yes, gentleman here. Please.
Hello, and nice to meet you. I'm an ordinary member of NLD, and I'm studying here from Parma. The religion conflictions is very huge in my country because people think that Buddhism, our country is the only Buddhist country in the Southeast Asia, and their original instinct is that this is their responsibility to preserve our religion in my country. They want to prevent the invasion of other religions, and it becomes a trap of military regimes as a key point to attack the Aung San Suu Kyi. So, this is a very sensitive issue and to tackle by Aung San Suu Kyi. So she trying to stay clear from these issues.
I completely agree, but do you have a question?
Yeah, my question is that how can she solve this problem and these religion conflictions, because this is very hard to negotiate with ethnic religions, especially now the situation changed to Christians. Now there's some conspiracy and to attack with Christians, religious peoples in my country. This is the current situation. What is the best solutions to stop religion conflictions in my country?
Well, I don't know. It's a good question, but I mean, one can see various ways of... basically, in these situations, you have to defuse. The tensions have to be defused. You have to, as far as possible, to take away the fuel from the fire. And so, I mean, before the election, the Mabata, this organized, rather... sinister Buddhist organization was whipping up a lot of opinion against Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD, saying that they are soft on Muslims, that they are not defending the Buddhist religion, etc., etc. But the result of the election, the parties which incarnated these views did very, very badly. The NLD completely wiped out the fanatical Buddhist parties. And it looked to me like it was an excellent moment for a politician of courage to say, good, we solved that problem. They didn't vote for Wiratu. They didn't vote for the Mabata-supported parties. So that gives us the opportunity for national reconciliation. But in that sense, I think we can always already say that the appointment of a man who is clearly friendly with the fanatical Buddhists as the religious affairs minister was a bad step. And the fact that he immediately went off to see Wiratu. Wiratu is a man who was described by Time magazine as the Buddhist Bin Laden, which is... it was a bit of a journalistic gimmick, but having met him and interviewed him myself, he's a pretty creepy character, and he's only interested in fomenting hatred against Muslims. So, you know, one hopes that Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD would take advantage of this massive mandate to go for national reconciliation. I don't see it happening yet.
Okay. Right, there are more questions. Yes, the lady with the long hair.
Thank you. I'm Sophie from the International Relations Department. It seems like the NLD is very much identified with Aung San Suu Kyi at the moment. Identified with Aung San Suu Kyi up until now, and that whenever anybody says NLD, it's the party that goes along with her. To what extent is that still true now and in the years to come? And to what extent do you see that the NLD sort of has an existence alongside her and that will keep going beyond her, if that makes sense?
The funny thing about the NLD is that you've got the founders, Aung San Suu Kyi, and mostly men who founded it with her in 1988. And then you've got quite a lot of much younger MPs and people in the party. And there's a huge age gap in the middle. The founding members are very old. U Tin U, who was spoken of as a possible president, is 89. I mean, he's in very good shape. I heard him speaking from the NLD headquarters the day after the election, and his voice was magnificent for an 89-year-old. But, that's the age they are. Win Thein is another lovely man who was a founding member, a very witty guy, the man you go to if you want to hear something a little bit off the record. But again, he's 87 or something. And then you've got the young MPs. Now, I think there are probably lots of very bright, idealistic, clever professional people who are now in Parliament as young NLD MPs. But they're very inexperienced, so they are going to be. There's going to be quite a long learning curve for them before they can actually aspire to having any kind of important role within the party. And you do see that Aung San Suu Kyi herself is not good at sharing power. If you ask who is, supposing she were unfortunately to be run over by a bus, who would step into her shoes? There isn't anybody. Who is her number two? Well, U Tin Jaw is the new president. But U Tin Jaw is not a political figure. He's somebody she went to school with when she was 12. He was a bureaucrat in ministries. He's obviously a nice guy, and he's been involved in the party, and his wife is an MP, etc., etc. But he was chosen because he poses no threat to her whatsoever. He will do exactly as he's told. So she is not collegial. Let's put it like that. She is not collegial. And in the longer term, that's a thing that's a little bit of a worry. I mean, you can see when they first announced the new government, she was the foreign minister, the education minister, the minister for energy, and the minister in the president's office. That's too much. She's dropped two of them, and instead she's now the state councillor. But for one she's very, very strong, but she's 70. It's unreal to have that kind of a workload and be expected to carry it out efficiently. This is where one worries about the NLD.
Yes, the question at the back. And the glasses.
My name is Robin Howarth. I'm a member of the public. You mentioned earlier that there were national reconciliation was one of the top three priorities for the new government. I was just wondering if you could talk about what you think the other two are. Thanks.
Well, the most obvious one is that the country is broke. the GDP is something like $11 billion. The estimated revenue from the unofficial sales of jade, none of which produces revenue for the government, is $33 billion. If she is going to do what her supporters want her to do, she's going to have to create prosperity and spread it through the country quite quickly, and she knows that's the case. I mean, she spoke about that eloquently before the election. She said that for all the reforms carried out by Thein Sein, the poor were still very, very poor. And I've seen that with my own eyes. You see people living in the middle of Rangoon, about half a mile from her own home, living in conditions of great simplicity, in tiny little houses with very, very... I mean, they have homes, but the homes are minuscule. And the amount they have for food, for education, for transport and so on is tiny. So the creation of prosperity is possibly the biggest challenge, and it's not a great moment in the economic cycle to be doing that when China is in trouble, and so that's, I think that's probably the biggest priority of the lot. Yeah.
I was wondering whether I could just sort of abuse my position and come in here at this point. I think you're obviously discussing this in the context of the situation in Burma. But what about the international community, the role that the United Kingdom, the United States can actually play when it comes to the efforts to promote economic development and greater prosperity? And what is your take on her relationship with London and Washington in this regard, and maybe more generally?
She is the only person in her government who could have fulfilled the job of foreign minister. She has the cell phone numbers of every leader in the West. And if Hillary Clinton wins the presidential election, she'll have a good friend in the White House. And Hillary Clinton's flight to Rangoon in November 2011 was probably after the crucial meeting with Thein Sein, was probably, one could say with hindsight, the symbolic moment when the change became irreversible in Burma. So in that respect, she is uniquely well placed. They know Cameron has been a great supporter, Obama likewise. So that's all very good. What happens next is the big question. She and her party have been extremely vague about what they want to happen in terms of economic development of the country and the sort of investments they want. And it seems that she quarrelled with the last American ambassador, Derek Mitchell, who was very energetic and seemed to me a very sound man. But again, this is something which we really don't know where they're going to go. Where the West has been involved in the previous government was in trying to push through a nationwide ceasefire, which was Thein Sein's big diplomatic project, was trying to bring peace among the ethnic groups, and which really was a resounding failure. Bertil Lindner, the Swedish commentator, says that he made the mistake of putting the cart before the horse, basically trying to get the ethnic groups to lay down their arms, essentially surrender before there was any political settlement on the table at all, as a result of which that, despite a great deal of Western involvement in terms of money and support, seems to be going nowhere. And there is enormous goodwill and quite a lot of money, I'm sure, that can be tapped from the West, but exactly how the government hopes to use it is not clear yet.
Okay, we'll move on to the next question. Yes, the gentleman
here on the right, or to my left, but on the right of the room.
Thank you. My name is Rolf. I study here at the LSE. My question is regards to her relationship with the religious establishment in Burma. And I would like to understand a bit more, if you can share your impressions about how does she look at the other big ethnic groups. Some of them have signed the ceasefire agreement. Some of the bigger ones are still engaged in active combat fighting, partially funded also by the Chinese government. So I would love to be very interested to get your views on that. Thank you.
When we say the religious establishment, you mean the Buddhist establishment?
And some of the ethnic groups are Christian, Baptist, for example, and the Quran.
Yes.
I don't know if you have any insights on that.
Well, I mean, she hasn't been very eloquent about this. You've got, as you know, the Buddhist Burman heartland is ringed by ethnic groups which have large numbers of Christians in them. The Chin, for example, are almost entirely Christian. The Kachin are largely Christian. The Karen, the Shan are mostly Buddhist. But there's never been. I mean, this. Their religious affiliation is one of the clear indicators of the fact that there has never been a united Burmese polity. Instead, what you've had for much of the post-independence years is an attempt at Burmanization. And you can go to remote parts of Chin State and see where Buddhist temples have been implanted at the regime's behest, despite the fact that the population is entirely Christian. So, I mean, this is the great conundrum of Burma, is how you make it a country when it's not really a country, when it is tens of dozens of different groups with different languages and different traditions, and then on the other side, on the east of the country, you have this very powerful and potentially a destructive group, the WA, and the United WA State Army, which is extremely well funded and is widely believed to be acting as a proxy for China, as a potential way for the Chinese to exercise influence through indirect military means. And the WA people, like the Kokang people, also on the eastern of the country, are ethnically Chinese. And if the Burmese have a lot of negative feelings about Muslims, they also have equally negative feelings about the Chinese. So this is all part of this very, very difficult jigsaw of Burmese ethnicities. And how it will be put together in a more satisfactory way than Thein Sein attempted to do it, we'll have to wait and see.
Yes.
What about Suu Kyi's relationship with the Chinese, who I gather work with the generals? Do you see that continuing with the current government?
Well, she quite correctly and intelligently, her first meeting with a foreign diplomat after the government took power was with the Chinese ambassador in Rangoon. One of the biggest issues on the agenda for the new government is what to do about this big dam in Kachin State, the Mitsone Dam. Thein Sein suspended work on this dam, which is a huge dam and massively controversial inside Burma, because it dams the Irrawaddy River, which is a sort of symbol of Burmese nationhood, and it exports almost all its electricity to China. So it's regarded as a sort of neo-colonial grand projet, which an awful lot of Burmese don't like. And Thein Sein's decision to suspend work on it stunned the Chinese, who were not accustomed to getting any kind of resistance to their wishes from the Burmese generals at all. And it's remained suspended ever since. The Chinese have been dropping loud hints about their desire to finish it off, understandably, after 5 years hiatus. And this is a very early nettle which she will have to get hold of. I mean, the Chinese presence is a real problem for Burma because it's so big and it's so close. And in the absence of economic activity by the West due to sanctions, the Chinese took a huge control of large parts of the economy, particularly in Mandalay and in northern Burma generally. And one of the reasons why the military regime decided to open to the West was because Chinese was getting overweening in its power, and they wanted some geopolitical counterbalance to Chinese power, which they have now got. Nonetheless, China remains a country which no Southeast Asian country finds it comfortable to deal with, simply because of its vast size and its relatively recent expansionist intentions.
But the relationship with China has obviously deteriorated. I mean, in 2015, arguably, it's reached its worst point since the late 80s or maybe even the 70s, as a result of the Kokang incident. And I'm just wondering what you think as to what Dorsu might wish to do, which doesn't necessarily have to do with Missile Dam, because, I mean, whether that project gets restarted or not, I mean, it's difficult to say, but most people might think rather not, it's not that likely. So if that doesn't happen, then how can she repair the relationship with China, which is obviously very important, in all sorts of terms?
Well, there's the other hot issue with China is the Lepadang copper mine, which was a joint project between the Burmese military and the Chinese. It's a copper mine in northeast of Mandalay in Sagaing State, where there were large-scale protests by the local people about the ecological damage being done and the confiscation of land, which is a very common problem throughout the country, but exacerbated by the fact that it was the Chinese who were part owners of the dam. It was interesting that Thein Sein, who can be a rather crafty politician, set up a commission of inquiry into the Lepadang protests, and he appointed Aung San Suu Kyi the head of the commission of inquiry, which I thought was quite a cunning way of putting her on the spot, because she actually couldn't simply denounce the government or denounce the Chinese from a safe distance. She actually had to get involved. And I think the Chinese must have been pleasantly surprised by the fact that the result of the commission was actually very soft on the Chinese. And it was a moment when you saw the first, and I think perhaps the only time so far, you saw Burmese opinion shocked by the realization that she wasn't necessarily always going to be the friend of the Burmese little people. But she said, these projects, Chinese investment is very important for Burma. We cannot throw them out. We need their investments, these protests have to stop. So, in that sense, the Chinese would have taken some hope from her attitude. How the relationship develops from there, well, as I say, it's too early to say.
Right. Okay. We move on to the next question. There was a lady over here. Yes.
Hi, I'm Felicia Yap. I'm an associate of the Southeast Asia Center, also a novelist. My question has to do with the creative or technical challenges of writing a biography of a woman whose image has at one level fluctuated in international opinion over time, and whose approach at the same time, who, as your talk implies, has veered increasingly from accessibility to inscrutability. So if you could say a bit more about the challenges of writing these biographies. Thank you.
Well, of course, I couldn't depend on the best source of all, which would have been her, because the whole time I was writing the first book, she was incommunicado. I couldn't get to her at all. And I interviewed her first in 2002 when she came out of house arrest. So I had met her then and formed some initial impressions. And I was very fortunate in that I got a lot of help from her family, her English family, the elder sister of Michael Harris, Lucinda, and the twin brother of Michael Harris, Anthony Harris, who died last year. But they gave me lots of help and insight, gave me some, showed me letters and talked about her life in England. I also met her school friends of hers from India, which was really interesting, people that she'd either been to school with in India or who'd then gone to Oxford with them, who gave me lots of interesting anecdotes, some nice photographs, and gradually the picture came together thanks to these people more than anything else. I've written most of the book when she came out of house arrest, and I was in Burma in 2010 for waiting for her to come out of house arrest, covering the 2010 election for the Independent. But unfortunately, the military worked out that I was in fact a journalist, not a tourist, and they threw me out before I could have a chance to interview her. Whereupon I was on the blacklist, which meant I couldn't, which was immensely frustrating, because I really wanted to interview her again and to ask her a series of questions to try and get the facts absolutely straight. And so I did actually contrive to get back into the country. I obtained a passport with a slightly different name, and I changed my appearance somewhat. I grew a beard and shaved my head, and I managed to get in. And after a great deal of trouble, Lucinda, with the help of her sister-in-law, Lucinda, I managed to get in to see Aung San Suu Kyi. And she told me, I write about this in the new book, so I'm not going to answer your questions. I never talk to biographers. And that was it. It was my first experience of Aung San Suu Kyi's notorious rudeness, which is something a lot of journalists could talk about. So, as I say, I had a lot of help, but not from her.
Okay, I think we now need to collect some questions as we are sort of running short of time. Maybe up to three questions. Yes, the gentleman right here in the middle, please. You can wait for the microphone just to...
Do you think the economic session of United States should be lifted right now?
Are you going to write these down? We'll answer three of them.
Yeah, you will have to answer three. I will sort of try and repeat them, yeah? Okay, please keep the questions very short.
Yeah. Thank you. I want to know about your opinions. United States sanctions for economic sanctions to our country should be lifted right now or keep going.
Okay, yeah.
The gentleman then sort of further back. Would you just wait for the microphone to arrive? Just a second. Thank you.
I'm a Burmese student from King's. I just wondering, you know, you talk about Aung San Suu Kyi relationship with Western countries and China. How about the Southeast Asian countries? And how can Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi can fully involve, you know...
South Asian or Southeast Asian?
Southeast Asian.
Southeast Asian.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and then one more, maybe? So, would you like to ask a question?
Where are her husband and sons buried? Where are they now?
So three questions.
Fair enough. Okay. Should we tackle those? Yes.
Sanctions should be lifted. Yeah.
Good question about the sanctions, because although the European Union has lifted most of the sanctions way back in 2012. A lot of the American sanctions, targeted sanctions at particular individuals, are still in place. And there are people in Burma, one particular American lawyer who claims to be the only American lawyer in Burma, and represents people who are called cronies, the very wealthy friends of the military. He says that the American sanctions are stopping economic activity in Burma because they are targeted on the people who are rich. And he says this is very wrong, because if you look at other countries in Southeast Asia like Vietnam or Cambodia, where there are very corrupt rich people in running the economy, they are not targeted with sanctions. So if they want Burma to stand on its feet and progress, they should let these cronies off. Well, it's a matter of opinion. But certainly, as in the case of Iran, the long life of American sanctions has can actually have a sort of a breaking effect on the return of countries to the international community. Second one
concerned her views on the relationships with other Southeast Asian countries.
Well, I'm afraid I don't have anything very useful to say about that. She visited Thailand. That was the first country she visited when she started travelling again in 2011. Beginning of 2012, and it was a shambles. That she didn't tell the Thailand government that she was coming, and they had to make it up as they went along. So I suspect that the relations with Southeast Asia are work in progress, let's put it like that. And about the very important question of her family relationships. Her husband, Michael, died very young on his 50th birthday, I think, in 1999, having devoted himself heart and soul to drawing attention to her plight and to Burma's plight ever since she went into house arrest. He was a really heroic and tragic fate. Alexander and Kim. Alexander lives in America. He's an American citizen. Kim lives in Oxford. And neither of them... I've met Kim. He's a lovely boy, incredibly good-looking. And neither of them have actually made a great deal of themselves in terms of education or public profile, and they're very, very shy of being interviewed. Basically, she chose a political path at a very difficult moment. She was well aware of it because the children were at an age when they really needed their mother, and she was an extremely hands-on mother, and suddenly she was not there. And she had no idea that the absence would go on such a long time. They thought that the whole thing would be resolved within months instead of 15 years. So, I mean, this is the tragic shadow that hangs over her and about which she has never really spoken with any clarity. There's a film, the only feature film made about her, by Luc Besson. Is that right? All right. Not a very good film, but Michelle Yeoh plays Aung San Suu Kyi, and she brings that tragic aspect of Suu Kyi brilliantly to life. It's a marvellous performance. Tellingly, Aung San Suu Kyi herself has never seen the film.
Okay. I think we have to bring this event to an end. It's really been a great pleasure listening to your fascinating account of Dorsu. I think it's quite easy to see why she has been the most popular and in some ways obviously also the most successful politician the country's recent past. Her legitimacy obviously in part depends on her being the daughter of Aung San, But her government now faces many, many challenges, and it will remain to be seen whether she's able to make sure that the government has the capacity to deal with these issues, and those are internal ones as well as issues that concern the country's foreign relations. So therefore, I think we will be following this with great interest, maybe a topic for your next book. And please join me in thanking Peter Poppen for this.
Thank you very much. Very nicely handled. Thank you.